Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. If you've seen something strange, a cryptid like Bigfoot, a ghost, a UFO, anything paranormal, or if you know of a story you think we should cover, you can email us strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com. Welcome back, Allison.
I hadn't realized I had gone.
Going to get into the second part of your interview of Josh and I for Where the Footprints End. Before we get to that, I just want to mention to everybody, if you like Strange Familiars and you want to help us out, the best way to do that is to become a patron at Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. Our patrons get full extra episodes of Strange Familiars every month. There are other levels of support there. You can see it all at Patreon, patreon.com/strangefamiliars. You can also make a one-time donation if you go to the show notes at strangefamiliars.com under any episode. Look for the paypal.me link. You can click on that, make a one-time donation via PayPal. And everyone can help by leaving us those 5-star reviews wherever you're listening, liking and sharing on social media, and make sure to hit that subscribe button. We go all over the place in this interview. We did in the first part. We continue to do so in the second part. So, without further ado, let's jump back into it and we'll get into more Bigfoot weirdness.
Do you find that there's a common experience for people who see Bigfoot? Like, is there one sort of spiritual or just one abiding thing that seems to connect the people? Like,
I mean,
if it has some sort of purposeful nature, if it's spiritual or if it's supposed to be like a harbinger of something, there should be some commonality to it. But sometimes it seems just, I mean, maybe that's just life generally, just totally random.
Well, I think that's the thing with the other. I think sometimes there's no sense to it at all. I think sometimes it's there just, you know, this feeds into that trickster thing, which mm-hmm. I don't even like to bring up for reasons that I think Josh has discussed other places, and that people tend to think that there's this like one entity that's a trickster out there that we're talking about. And, you know, it's more of a concept, and it's more of a way that the other acts. And I think sometimes it's just random. It's just this random thing to reach out and touch people, maybe to show them that there's more out there than they realize, or that the materialist world would have them know. But maybe it's just completely random.
But it does seem to be tied to a cultural moment too. You know, like, are people seeing and back to kind of what the way we started, like, are people seeing Bigfoot now? And they, in 1994, they would have seen a gray alien. In 1965, they would have seen a little green Martian man. In 1940, they would have seen something that looked like, you know, whatever the contemporary science fiction was.
Right.
And then all the way back into, you know, the year 1300, where they see, you know, a fairy or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally think so. I think that if I would say that there's some sort of common thread and sort of piggybacking off of what Tim said, I believe that George Hansen would say that one of the functions of the trickster archetype is to re-enchant or to enchant the world. And I think that that is the most common thing. If you had to boil it down, I know that's sort of a loose concept for people, but even the people who think that they saw a flesh and blood creature, which I'm not saying they didn't, but even people who have like a really like, no, it was a giant ape man, they're like, they don't go back to normalcy. They don't resume normalcy. You know, yeah. something changes in them. Something breaks in them. People don't go back hunting into the woods like they used to for years before, because everything's topsy-turvy, and it really just sort of does kick open the door for them to be a lot more receptive to some other things, unless they're part of a very established large Bigfoot research organization.
So is it just the idea that just a little cue to entertain possibility, that it doesn't matter whether it's based on intent or accident, it's just the fact that it's there to... Is that what the re-enchantment means to both of you, that just entertaining possibility?
I mean, I think that's part of it. You know, I think you can court it, and I think people have done so, and I think I do. Not that I even necessarily think whatever I've encountered has been Bigfoot necessarily, or has always been Bigfoot. Boy, it's hard to talk about. But you know, I think you can court it, at which I would tell people to be careful if they're doing that. But
is it because of that like sort of trickster ironic element that everyone thinks is there, like, oh, don't go lurking there because you'll never get exactly what you think you're going to get out of it? I that idea that you shouldn't go seeking because you might not get what you expect, you're never going to get what you expect. To me, it's always purposeful to be seeking.
In my experience, you're not going to get what you expect.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, maybe if you set out with very open expectations, or no expectations, rather.
I think that would be prudent, you know. Yeah. And I don't know that I've
or every
done
expectation.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, certainly, and I've talked about this on the show before, after talking with Brother Richard and him kind of, you know, and I'd heard this idea before, this idea that what you kind of expect, in some measure, you may get. So if you go out in a very, very fearful state, expect to be scared. And after talking to him and being, you know, in these same situations and just being generally more open and trying to be more calm and more positive, the experiences themselves, at least from my perspective, have been, you know, less scary and so forth. So in some way, there's a measure of you may get what you bring to it out of it. But there's also, and this is something that I warn people when they start to play with this stuff, this phenomenon is very capricious and it can change on a dime. And sometimes you will get something that, you know, you do not want at all out of it. And I feel like I lost the thread there, Allison. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. But I mean, it doesn't, that theory though, that you're sort of, you're bringing that on yourself though, is an idea that I don't like in general, in life generally, like this idea that you're responsible for your station in life. Why should that be something on the spiritual plane if you don't believe that in the physical plane?
Oh, that's very interesting.
Because that's something we talk about a lot, because, you know, so often people will sort of allude to the fact that you bring on an illness or you're responsible for it in some factor. Mm-hmm. And I find that very, very distasteful personally, because I just don't feel like little kids bring on cancer. I don't feel like anybody brings on a particular disability or tragedy to their life. That I don't think people are actively courting the kind of horrors that some people have seen in their lives.
My own brother said that I had MS because I had a vitamin D deficiency because I never went outside, which is patently, I was outside more than anyone in that family, and still to this day I'm outside, you know, plenty. It was the most like bizarre thing that he said. It was like, wow, I guess a little window into what you think of me there, but you don't know me.
Well, I mean, isn't that the same idea? Like, families are the very embodiment of a bunch of people who have the same experience, but yet see things in a completely different way.
Isn't that true? At least in terms of mine.
Right. Some people see a white Bigfoot. Some people see a black Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Some people see no Bigfoot at all.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I really got lost there. Sorry, guys.
That's okay.
No. I was just thinking to myself, this has been the most refreshing interview because we're going, you know, off the reservation a bit. And it's nice because Mike Clellan said a while back that if you start talking about UFOs and you don't wind up talking about the meaning of God or what reality is or the meaning of life or something, you're probably having the wrong UFO conversation. And but that conversation so rarely happens when talking cryptozoology, because there's been this real, you know, flesh and blood fetishism that I think with certain cryptids will eventually bear fruit. But you know, we're how many years into the scientific study of Bigfoot as a large flesh and blood mammal, and we haven't gotten anywhere. So let's try a different tactic. And it's interesting, as soon as you try that different tactic, you wind up going down these other avenues that are much more in line with basically every other facet of the paranormal, you know, everything from hauntings to UFO sightings to, you know, psychics and all that sort of thing.
I would argue intellectually more rewarding as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it just like the my assumption would be that the flesh and blood phenomenon has something to do with just a need for validation and the need to have seen something quote unquote real.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you don't want to invalidate something that was such an important experience by saying that it wasn't really real, because then it calls into question your sanity, your judgment. And that's not a happy place to be when someone calls into question your sanity and your judgment. So if you can find some scientific validation, that would be wonderful. You could say, yes, I saw this. This is something that's real. Ha ha.
Right.
I got you. But
there's an excellent book that I've come across, and I'm not sure if he wants me to mention his name or not, because he is a professor at a university. But he did this great, it really is a great book that I've incorporated into volume two, where he sort of looks at the outlooks and the philosophies of different groups and, but along not only gender lines, but also, you know, subjects of interest. And one of his conclusions about the Bigfoot group is that more so than almost any other paranormal group, Bigfooters are just view themselves as people who are normal people who just happen to hunt for Bigfoot on the weekends. They don't see that really impacting any other aspect of their life. And
as part of one singular event or one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Yeah, exactly. It's this drive for validation under our current, I would say, restrictive parameters for what the scientific method is, that they want to sort of conform to. And I just don't think many, if any, of these phenomena are gonna fit into that. It's like trying to cram a square peg into a round hole.
I have to say that after, I don't, whatever, 70 years of, you know, intense materialist scientific Bigfoot research that has yielded really some pretty cool casts of footprints and not a whole heck of a lot else, the reaction, at least from the general public, to Volume 1 and Where the Footprints End has been surprisingly open-minded, I felt. It's almost as if people were ready for something more.
I would agree with that. I was expecting a lot more hate mail at this point. but that may also be just the fact that people who would send us the hate mail look at that and they go, these people are crazy.
Right.
But it also reminds me of the fact that there's another quote that I wish I could attribute. Someone who talked about how certain things have their own time and place to happen. And the example that he used was that, you know, tea kettles whistled the secret to steam locomotion in the Industrial Revolution for, you know, centuries before anybody was like, hey, we can actually use this to become industrialized, because at that time it was, you know, it was steam engine time. It just is that point in the timeline. And, you know, maybe we see a similar thing unfold in certain, you know, paranormal disciplines. Obviously, you'd have some of the conversations that I regularly have about UFOs with people from 30 years ago. They'd look at me like, you know, I had an extra arm growing out of my forehead or something.
Right, right.
But the UFO community is finally very much in line with the idea that consciousness plays a role, that perception plays a role, that altered states play a role. And maybe we're just seeing the Bigfoot community sort of opening up to those ideas as well, because it's just at this point in the timeline that these ideas become more palatable.
So you guys are basically like the mold on the bread of the proto penicillin of spiritualist Bigfoot.
Yes.
I've been called worse, so there's that.
Eat the moldy rye. Tell us what you see.
Oh, where were we before that? I'm like totally lost now.
That's
all. How do you do that? This is where Tim usually says in the interview, that's interesting.
or Soraya goes, pause. Okay. Witches, werewolves, fairies, women in white, ghosts. Although Strange Familiars listeners are probably tired of women in white by now.
I haven't talked about it a ton on Strange Familiars. I've talked about it a ton everywhere else.
Well, the other thing I was, if we're kind of reconfiguring the Bigfoot phenomenon, is it fair to say that these other things like women in white and fairies are just sort of like the fossil residue of Bigfoot in a way, like the spiritual fossil residue?
Wow.
Like if you're looking for fossils, you know, if you're looking for a fossil record, could there be a spiritual fossil record that you're following? And the other thing if you want to veer away from that, the other thing I was thinking, I wanted to ask Josh in regard to fairies, is this the first phenomenon where people are actively hunting it? Like there weren't a lot of people looking for, like going out purposely looking for aliens, I think, in the same way that people purposely look for Bigfoot. Is there any sort of precedent with that within fairies? Or, I mean, we have ghost hunters, but all of this seems like slightly more modern to me, at least culturally.
Not to jump in Josh's way here, but
no, it's fine.
I think the idea that you can capture a wild man, that you can have a specimen of a wild man, really comes post Darwin. You don't find that idea a lot before Darwin. It's only like, you know, really around the time of Darwin happens that you start getting the articles in the newspaper of wild man captured, you know, hairy man captured, you know, the creature shot and will be on display at town hall.
Well, it's almost at the same time that you start to see the first, that sort of Victorian cabinets of curiosity,
yes,
turn into the modern day museums.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you start to see something caught. And scientifically, I can hold this shell from 3,000 miles away in my hand now. I can see this butterfly, and it really exists. It isn't, mm-hmm, a fairy somewhere in Brazil. This is a real butterfly.
Right, right. So it's right around that. You know, before then, I mean, I can't think of, maybe they exist, but I can't think of any medieval tales of, like, you know, groups of knights going out to try to capture the local wild man. You know, perhaps they exist, but, you know, this idea really comes into vogue or fruition post Darwin, where it's like now we can capture and now we can get a specimen. On to Allison's point, Josh, do they have like fairy hunting parties that you knew of?
I mean, it's certainly not as organized. I think it's more of a personal sort of quest. I think that the idea that these things can be tied to place and can actively be hunted, like you said, is more of a recent thing. I still think it's folly to really go looking or hunting for UFOs. I mean, you can go to like a UFO hotspot and stare up at the sky with night vision goggles, and some people claim they see stuff, and some people say that they, you know, if you look at the C-SETI stuff, that they call in UFOs. But I just think I just don't think that's the way these things operate. It's like trying to capture lightning in a bottle. Like, they don't, happen because you're there. They happen because they choose to. That's the reason that I initially found ghost hunting so appealing, is because, you know, you can actually go to a haunted house and you can stay there. You don't have to, like, you know, go traipsing around. I think it sort of rose with this idea of, oh, well, how about we play by materialist science's playbook, and we're gonna go to the place and find evidence, and we're gonna control all these variables that we can. And I just think that, I don't want to say it's falling out of vogue, because it's still very much happening, but I think as we see the doors open to other scientific paradigms, like perhaps something like idealism or you know, panpsychism or something, that we're going to see less of a concerted effort to literally travel to a spot and try to find something. But that's a very good question that I am not entirely sure I have a really good answer for. I think Tim probably did a better job than I could.
I mean, it really wasn't until, you know, the teens that we even attempted to find fairies and capture them, and they're really just paper cutouts.
Well, oh, yes. I think that the Cottingley photos you're referencing.
Yeah. That have been sort of a cultural no-no to go and try to capture a fairy?
Oh, I mean, 100%. I think that the idea that we should actually engage with this is a relatively new concept as well. I mean, the number of, sort of ties into what we're talking about with, you know, these being warning tales to, mm-hmm. to children and whatnot. The idea that we should actually try to go out and engage with this, as Tim said, has historically been regarded as just a horrible idea.
I'm laughing because I was at White Bank, or White Pond rather, with Chad last weekend, and he's like, do the chant. So there's at Pond Bank, there's this legend of this woman in white, and the legend goes, you stand on the bank of the pond and you say, white lady, I have your baby, to the woods, and she will appear on the other side of the pond. So Chad's like, you know, do the chant, you know, do it. You're the wizard. Say the chant. So I said, you know, very, very prominently to the dark woods from, you know, across the pond. I said, white lady, I have your baby. And then Chad proceeds to just walk over to the other side, and I'm like, what are you doing? he's like, I'm gonna go over there. I'm like, we've just done what we're not supposed to do.
Okay, like, strange familiars listeners, I need you to start bugging Tim for shirts that say, you're the wizard, do the chant. We need those strange familiars t-shirts.
There's a famous time in our early courtship where Tim says to me, ask me, based on a song, like, come with me to the fairyland of Tiernanoke, and I just said, no. Just very... very bluntly, no.
I mean, and I'll be honest. Like, I when I was in Ireland, I went out one night, which I'm kicking myself. But, you know, it's another thing to say, I'm going to go out to, you know, these fairy sites at night. And it's another thing to be in your cozy bed at 3 a.m. with a wife who doesn't want to go. And you're like, I'm just going to go back to sleep. But we did go out one night around Loch Dur, which has several sites that were all in close proximity. So we sort of did a little, like, sort of 3 a.m. tour of Loch Dur, or... And actually, no, it wasn't 3 a.m. It was like 9 p.m. We went to do it before we went to bed. And these places, I mean, there is something about them that really will... something doesn't want you there. And I don't know if that's, you know, psychosomatic or whatever, but you get a sense that even if there's nothing to any of these supernatural phenomena, some places just don't feel right. I don't know if that's, you know, an ancient, you know, prey response that we have or something along those lines, but some places just don't want you there at night.
I would agree with Pond Bank. I would agree with that 100%. You know, Chad and I are often in these weird places, like way out in the middle of nowhere. Pond Bank's right beside a town. There's nothing, you know, it's not remote. You can see lights, you know, in the distance from the actual pond. There's
human lights.
Just natural, you know, street lights and homes and so forth. But there's something about Pond Bank that I just have this complete visceral reaction to at night, where I'm just like, I don't want to be here.
Or like Gettysburg, where it's that idea that during the day you have a totally different experience than at night there as well. I feel like that's one of those places that does turn at nighttime.
It's a very different feeling at night, and I would
agree. And in schools at night. Holy cow. You
know. Yeah, yeah, that's like, that does have a totally different feel.
I think Jeff Ritzman would probably have a lot to say about the idea of schools and liminality.
Yeah, yeah, probably so. And well, also the idea that you're used to seeing this. I mean, it's the same thing we've seen during the lockdown, these shots of New York that are just empty streets. You know, it's like, that shouldn't be that way. There are usually tons of people here. Why is there no one here?
And then is that also like sort of like the prime time for something else to sneak through that we might not see at another time?
Well, there's been some interesting... So one of the big criticisms that a lot of skeptics will say are like, you know, why do you do ghost hunts at night? Shouldn't you be doing them in the day when you can see stuff? And if there's an actual phenomena, why would it manifest at night? But there are some actual lines of thought. I believe if memory serves, I knew Gordon White talked about it, and I believe he was talking to Jack Hunter about the idea that literally there might be something about photons, some might be something about light that kind of kills or cleanses these phenomena. Something we talk about in Volume 1, I talk about it very briefly because it's just too big of a story to get into, is the Adam Davies portal experience, where he went to a site in the Pacific Northwest that was, he was going there to see Bigfoot. And Adam Davies, for those of you who don't know, is a flesh and blood cryptozoologist through and through. And he really didn't want to tell the story, but word got out that while he was there, this portal opened and there were these little things that kind of sound like, you know, angry, murderous Ewoks. These little tiny Littlefoot, red-eyed Littlefoot would come pouring out of this portal that had this, you know, strange color on the other side, and they would be repelled whenever they shine their flashlights at these things. And if anybody's interested, there's a Banal of America episode where they talk about this at length, and I think it's probably the best, most comprehensive description of the encounter. To me, it was one of the most harrowing things I've heard, because you've got someone who is still, you know, Adam Davies is still, you know, he's sort of the Orang Pendek guy. He's the guy looking for the wild man of island Southeast Asia. And he's convinced that a lot of these things are flesh and blood, but he's like, what I saw was not, there was nothing natural about that. And that was one of those moments where I was like, oh, that's really wild that somebody like that would come out, you know, under duress, basically, and finally be like, yeah, I did see this. I didn't want to talk about it because it sort of, you know, sullies my reputation looking for these things through a scientific lens. But yeah, this actually really did happen to me. And that idea that these things would be repelled by shining light at them, I think there's something to that idea that light is actually a prophylactic against all these phenomena.
So is it a virus?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. You know, I mean, the, you know, sunlight being the best disinfectant.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is, if we can shine light into Bigfoot's lungs, sorry, that was not a political statement. It was just a zeitgeist statement. Sorry, folks.
So when people are listening back later, they'll say, "Was this during 2020?" And we'll go, "God, I hope it was 2020 and not 2023 when the same things are happening."
Everyone knows Bigfoot's just drinking bleach anyway. That's how he's curing himself.
That's why you get white Bigfoot. Although that white Bigfoot thing is, and you did a really good job in Volume 1 talking about white Bigfoot, Tim, about how, you know, in terms of being an adaptation, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah, and so we often talk about, you know, the hunters that see Bigfoot in the woods or the people that have the roadside crossing, and how it's, they're most often the people who are insistent it's a natural creature, and how we don't blame them, because, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, what they see certainly appears as such. But I've also talked to a number of people who've seen white creatures who were convinced from the start, like, this isn't right, because it's too easy to see. Like, there shouldn't be something big and white in the woods. And, you know, that's part of it. That's certainly part of it. I think the instances of albinism in animals is something like 1 in 20,000 to 1 in a million. It's you know, they don't have it. That's a big figure, I know.
And it's dependent on the species, right?
Probably, yeah. But that's just the general number that when I did the research came up. So the fact that, you know, Bigfoot is this incredibly rare animal that people aren't seeing, you know, if it is an animal, a natural animal, it's something that people aren't seeing every day. It's an incredibly rare thing. The percentage of white Bigfoot reports is so incredibly high that you have to sort of eliminate albinism as the reason for these white Bigfoot. I mean, the number of white Bigfoot that people see is incredibly high. So now we have this population of white creatures running around that are giants. There's, you know, 8 to 10 foot tall, huge, giant hair-covered creatures that are white, that are able to somehow stay hidden in the woods. And at night, it just sort of defies logic. So, you know, it's again that we have this problem of if there's a breeding population, now there's a breeding population that includes white-haired creatures, and, you know, how are they staying hidden? It's just a real, you know, difficult problem to work out as far as a breeding population.
And a slight little detour here. You know, there are other things that can cause white creatures that aren't, you know, just, you know, some sort of familial genetic passing on or albinism. Have either of you seen a white alligator? And I don't mean an albino alligator. I mean a white alligator.
I don't think I have.
So white alligators are either albino or they're white alligators. So the albino alligators have pink eyes, but these white alligators, if you ever look them up, they have the most gorgeous blue eyes. It's an odd little trait of that. Apropos of nothing, I just thought of that. Now everybody at home is going to Google white alligator blue eyes.
and it isn't a variant of albinism, because I know some people with albinism have, you know, it can be more profound.
It is not. It's a pigment deficiency, from what I recall.
Oh, more so than...
So more akin to piebaldism than albinism.
Yes, I think it's a good way to put it.
Interesting. Even still,
white alligators are still a strong rarity too.
Right, and I think everyone would agree that a hell of a lot easier to see a white alligator in the swamp than a green or brown one.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes no biological sense, really.
Well, which is why, if memory serves, like whenever they find white alligators, there usually is an effort at a local level to like get them into zoos, because they know that they're probably not going to last long otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Welcome to Gator Talk.
You want to talk about some albino gators?
You want to talk about albino alligators? Yeah.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I feel like this is a good segue into circus people.
Well, I mean, circus wild men. Like, can we tie the wild man phenomena into the circus wild men?
Well, we certainly have the same people at play. We have people with albinism. We have wild men. We have
people have that, on the fringes of society.
We have that's exactly what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm. We have mind readers. We have people who are spiritualists. We have people that are androgynous, who have women who have beards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the other loves the circus. I mean, look at how many phantom clown sightings there were a couple of years ago. The imagery and the pageantry of the circus, of the carnival, which, I mean, you know, carnival, again, you know, in Catholicism was definitely a sort of liminal point.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and aren't clowns just sort of tricksters, the masked figures that, you know, you're not really quite sure what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. Whether they're going to be mm-hmm. happy or sad, they're both things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're trickster archetypes, and they appear not only in these phantom clown sightings, but also, you know, in alien abductions and in DMT experiences too. It's a very common thing to not only see
Terrence McKenna's self-transforming machine elves, but to also see
you know, clowns and alien greys and all these things.
And I didn't even ask Allison to craft questions to lead Josh into his Terrence McKenna impression.
I would like to know what other famous impressions you can do within the paranormal or psycho-spiritual realm.
I'll do some off air because they might be offensive to some paranormal personalities out there.
And Terrence McKenna's dead now, right?
Yes. Saint Terry has been laid to rest. Yes.
You can also now do Ram Dass, which is basically the same voice.
Who is also dead?
Yeah. I think the only thing we've yet to do is weave this back into the Marvel universe somehow.
There was an X-Man named Sasquatch.
Sorry to, well, actually you, but it was an Alpha Flight member.
Oh my lord! Okay.
Yeah, don't.
I just got wizard splained here.
Nerd splained.
Tim, I was just thinking about that quote. Is it from Macbeth? Blood becomes mm-hmm. blood. Stones have been known to move, and trees to speak. Is that what the quote is?
Yes.
You had.
Yes.
I was thinking about that in terms of basically the whole phenomenon with the, and it's one of the witches that says it, right? Or is that one? I can't remember who says it.
No, I think it's.
It's Lady Macbeth, isn't it?
It will have blood. They say blood will have blood. I think it's Macbeth who says
Macbeth
it.
Himself.
Stones have been known to move, and trees to speak.
I was thinking about that in terms of Bigfoot, about the stones and being known to move, being thrown, and trees to speak.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a. I think I reference the forest in Macbeth in Volume 2 when I get into tree structures and so forth. I think I reference that, don't I, Josh? I'm trying to remember.
I believe you do. And, you know, there's sort of, if we really wanted to blow this out into a third volume, which I have no desire to do, but you could sort of pick and choose from both volumes. There's this sort of through line of, like, it's going to sound really weird, folks, Bigfoot as trees. Mm-hmm. Like Bigfoot, I mean, even people like Ron Moorhead, who's not a flesh and blood hypothesis. Well, he sort of straddles the line between the weird hypothesis and this flesh and blood hypothesis. But he claims that the knocking is these Bigfoot kind of. He's hypothesized that the knocking sound is not actually a knock; it's some sort of energetic snap when Bigfoot come in and out of trees. Mm-hmm. And the number of people who say that they saw what looked like a giant stump or a dead log, and then it started moving and it looked like a Bigfoot. Those stories are legion.
Oh yeah,
go ahead.
We have more than a few of people. The one with that kid was hunting, I think it was in Washington State, and he observed through his scope a creature basically becomes completely still and take the form of a stump. And he said he saw two other hunters walk by it and actually, like, jump at it. They were startled at first, but then just kind of walked away from it. And then after these hunters leave, this kid sees this thing essentially, like, get up and walk away as a Bigfoot again. I mean, incredible.
Is he just a forest spirit? I mean, is that basically what Bigfoot is? It's the return of the forest spirit. The harbinger. The fact that he's happening at the same time as all of this environmental upheaval can't be coincidental.
I think in a big way. And so given where we are culturally at the moment, I didn't do a ton of research as far as like Native American folklore and wild men. There's plenty of it there. I mean, it's, you know, it's throughout, you know, Native American culture. It's there. But I did do a lot of European wild man research. And what are, you know, my ancestors from the Germanic and Norse people, what they were talking about when they were calling these nature spirits or earth whites certainly behave a lot like Bigfoot. I mean, many, many ways. Like the Venn diagram, the crossovers, is massive between what they would have just considered a forest spirit and what we would call a Bigfoot. Is, for my money, we're talking about probably the same thing.
Well, and this sort of ties into, again, I know I'm turning into the therefore fairies guy, but again, the fairy folklore, it's hard to pin down where these fairy legends began, but there's a solid section of scholars who think that they began as, you know, genus loci, these spirits of place. which definitely ties into like the idea of, oh, this forest has a forest guardian that is, you know, this or that. And, you know, you mentioned specifically the indigenous folklore of North America. I did find a legend which appears in volume two of this. Basically, it's an indigenous story of this large hairy man thing that has a special name amongst this particular tribe. I don't have it right here in front of me. But he actually is, there's a warrior who is dying, and this big hairy Bigfoot comes along and opens up, like, he basically cuts into himself, and what pours out of this wild man is tree sap, this tree sap that sort of nurses the dying man back to life. If I might have some of those details wrong, but that's the basic idea, is that there's this Bigfoot tree hybrid man that helps. So, you know, there's definitely some of that as well. And I think it's interesting because this kind of gives me a little bit of sympathy for the blob squatchers out there. You know, these people who will show you a picture of, you know, a tree line, and they'll have a giant red circle around something and be like, you know, that's the Bigfoot, and he's holding its baby. It's always got a baby, right?
And it's holding a baby.
But it kind of makes you one, you know, kind of casts that in a more forgiving light, I think.
It does.
And yeah, because of what I was thinking when you were talking about the tree syrup and the sap, it's like really Mother Nature literally nursing us back to health.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And that's another thing. There's some stories in volume one of Bigfoot sort of fulfilling sort of a cunning man or a medicine man sort of role. Even some more modern sightings of, like, I think there's an example of a guy who gets snake bit, and the Bigfoot fashions a poultice and puts it over the guy's leg and carries him back down the mountain. Which, again,
or the little boy who lived with the bear for a while.
Well, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, there's your very, very modern, you know, in a sense, wild man story, because, you know, I mean, whatever happened...
Someone took care of that kid, right? Because he wasn't taking care of himself for that
exactly
long.
Whatever happened to that boy, a bear didn't take care of him, you know?
Well, a flesh and blood bear didn't.
Okay, sure, yeah.
A member of the Ursus genus did not take care of the boy.
Yeah. Yeah, so whatever happened there, you know, and we'll never know, you know. But I mean, very much to my mind, this is very much this modern wild man story. Like, something wild, presumably, took care of this boy.
And whether it was Mother Nature itself, or in some capacity, or a wild person.
And as long as we're talking about garnering sympathy for marginalized Bigfoot groups, which is a sentence I never thought I'd say, this does...
Wait. I think this is the first time anyone's ever said that sentence anyway.
Fair enough.
Are we exploring Bigfoot intersectionality?
Yeah, I guess. Seems like the right time.
Sorry, Josh, continue.
No, that's fine.
Sympathy for marginalized Bigfoot groups.
Yeah, it does... you know, generate some sympathy for the people who are like, if you go into a forest with a gun, they'll know you're there. And they all know that that's what you want to do. Or if you go in looking for them, they'll know you're there. And if you don't, if you come in with, you know, ideas of peace and love in your heart, and you just want to communicate with the Bigfoot people from the stars or whatever, they'll come out and, you know, shake your hand. It gives that idea a little bit more credence that, you know, just like so many of these other phenomena, a big part of it is what you're bringing to the table. Which, again, ties in with that perception, altered
intent.
States. Yeah, intent idea, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The gifting aspect.
Yeah, I mean, well, I get into intent in a big way with gifting, if you want to go there. So, yeah, as far as intention, I mean, it plays a huge role in this gifting phenomenon. Even the flesh and blood folks. So, I had great fun writing the gifting chapter, because certain flesh and blood hypothesis folks have these rules they've set out for gifting, and they will tell you that, you know, Bigfoot's a natural creature and you should never give him food because he will grow dependent upon your food, and if you ever stop giving him food, he will, you know, have a temper tantrum and you know, kill your dogs and beat on the side of your house and climb on your roof and so forth. And they lay out this idea, however, that if Bigfoot's going through your garbage, that doesn't count if he's eating your trash and your garbage. It only counts if you leave it out on a stump, say. And I bring the point up, if this is some kind of, you know, relict hominids, undiscovered primate, whatever it is, how does a Bigfoot know that you're not treating this your trash can as this, you know, gifting receptacle to it, or that in turn, like, a stump isn't just where you leave your discarded garbage. How would this creature know the difference? And it really comes down to intent. And they're saying, basically, if you leave candy bars out on a stump, it's gifting. You're leaving food for Bigfoot there. If you throw the same candy bars in your trash can, it doesn't count. Right there, it's 100%. You're talking about intent. Even with the flesh and blood guys, they're talking about intent. They also say that you should plant a Bigfoot garden away from your own garden, closer to the tree line, and that somehow, in some way, the Bigfoot will recognize this garden as being for them, the special Bigfoot garden, and they will leave your garden alone, and they will only then eat from the Bigfoot garden. This goes against any kind of wisdom when it comes to animals in general, or caloric opportunists. Any animal given that would just, oh, now I have two places from which to eat. So again, this comes down to intention, and what they've basically done here is, like, you've built this, like, dedicated space to Bigfoot, this dedicated sort of offering area to Bigfoot, and this goes with spirit gifting throughout the ages. People have done this, and we have example after example in the book of these old fairy stories, where, for instance, where people would start feeding a brownie and then stop, and the brownie then gets very angry and kills their livestock, or, you know, damages their house, or beats on their walls and so forth. All of these things Bigfoot is said to do when you stop feeding him, by the way. And they'll say that...
Well, because he's a wild man, they're treating him the same way they treat people who are in poverty.
In what sense? I mean, very it's, basically, it, yes, but I'm wondering...
If I mean, is the Salvation Army, is it a place where people have wonderful intent, or is it a place where people are giving away their garbage?
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you're treating people... Yeah. I mean, like, that whole idea, if you would take away Bigfoot and put in poor people, people apply those same that same reasoning for why you shouldn't be generous, because people become dependent on it. So what you should do is make a segregated area.
Wow.
So that the people don't come and ruin your things.
Isn't this interesting? Yeah, I mean...
And that they've known that you have given it as a gift, that it's just a gift.
Right.
But it's not charity.
This is an interesting angle that, I mean, I never even considered this. You know,
so you're treating the wild man, the poor, the impoverished wild man, the same way. I mean, the fact that we so often see these racist tropes intertwined with early Bigfoot sightings, and the way that we deal with people that are impoverished generally, to me, there's no coincidence, that there's a synchronicity there, and it's not because of some magical thinking, it's because of racism.
Well, let me pick up my brains off the floor, Allison.
Yeah, well,
you blew my mind.
Yeah, I did not extend the metaphor into modern society at all. I kind of went backwards with it and looked, again, at spirit gifting, and... You know, the best example of spirit gifting, the easiest one is we leave milk and cookies out for Santa. That's what we do. You know, that's our little spirit gift to Santa, and he brings his presents. So I went backwards with it. In no way did I try to frame this in terms of sort of modern society. And I'm literally kind of gut punched at the example.
That's super consistent. If you look at so one thing I talk about in volume one is how the discovery of pygmies was at once racist and tied into fairy lore, because they were viewed as sort of like perhaps these were what our people described as fairies, because they're tiny and they mm-hmm. seem subhuman. And the racist Bigfoot interpretation is something that is really threaded through all this, to the extent of, you know, categorizing other races other than, you know, Western Europeans as being subhuman, and also looking at the Bigfoot as being subhuman, as being sort of a missing link between, you know, the animal and the man. That's entirely in line with that.
Allison, just to toss it back to you, how many circus wild men were in blackface?
Well, or like one of the most famous of Barnum's early circus, I guess if you want to call them superstars, was called Zip. also known as the What Is It, he becomes, I don't know if anybody saw that, it's not very politically correct anymore, Zippy the Pinhead is based on this character of a real man from New Jersey who was named Zip, but he was also known as the missing link sometimes. And then there was a little girl who had a form of hirsutism and was very hairy, and she was known as, I guess it's a biblical character, K-R-A-O, Crow. I'm going to defer to Josh here, maybe he knows, but there was someone who was particularly hairy in the Bible, and so they named her...
Esau, yeah.
Yeah, Esau, yeah, or yeah. Esau, and then it's like K-R-A-O, I don't know if that's like another one that's somehow biblical, but they would name these people after biblical characters or the missing link and try to tie them in that way. It's also because sometimes with the circus, they tried to imply that there was a sort of like a scientific tenet to what they were doing that was for edification process, for like an edification as opposed to just merely gawking at people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and tell me if I'm drawing too long of a bow here, but Tim, have you ever seen Datus Perry's Bigfoot illustrations, his Bigfoot cutout?
I've not seen his illustrations. I've seen and read his accounts and seen him interviewed, but no, I have not seen his illustrations.
I just saw one for the first time the other day, and it has this extremely exaggerated sagittal crest. And you're talking about Zip.
Mm-hmm. There are people who are sometimes people like the man who I can't remember his name, William Henry Johnson, I think was his name. Some people actually were microcephalic.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a slightly more distorted facial features.
I'm interrupting you because I want to make sure I get this codified in my head. I mean, so obviously sagittal crests have a precedent in apes, especially if you look at gorillas having a pointed head. Mm-hmm. But if you think about some of the things that people talk about Bigfoot, they say pointed head and large teeth, right? And wasn't that sort of a part of those distorted features? Oftentimes they would have larger sort of, or more prominent teeth as well.
Oh, like the people that were within the circus who had some sort of medical anomalies.
I'm going to use the term, and I again, obviously not appropriate, but like didn't a lot of pinheads have sort of these forward thrust teeth?
Yeah. And I think that, yeah, I'm not sure if that was because of where the jawline lands generally or missing portions of your brain, how that affects the structure of the skull.
So what I'm wondering is if maybe those sort of features kind of got imported onto, again, we're not saying that people are making this up, but like it got sort of imported into people's idea of what quote unquote subhuman would be. And they're sort of projecting that onto this as well.
Well, they're like a popular cultural reference for it that becomes what they see.
There is definitely, and again, this is something we really should have gotten into. You know, this is for the non-existent volume 3. The circus, and Josh, you mentioned this before, but the more we talk about this, it is really entwined in the wild man thing. From the idea of the wild man being escaped circus gorillas that are in, you know, many of the articles that I've collected from my Bigfoot in Pennsylvania and West Coast Wild Man books, to naming creatures after circus wild men. A lot of them were known as, they would actually, when people would see these, you know, Bigfoot, sometimes they would call them...
Oh, the wild men of Borneo, yeah.
A lot of these, you know, these Bigfoot sightings in the past, they call them the wild men of Borneo. There's one in Washington State, in the West Coast Wild Man book, where they were calling him... Oh, I'm trying to remember the name.
There's still kind of a place we can carve out for this in my Trickster chapter for volume 2.
If you want to go there.
in the ever metastasizing volume 2.
But in any case, this creature in Washington that they were seeing, they named after, basically it was a circus wild man that had come through some weeks before. They started seeing this Bigfoot creature, so they just started Bosco. They called it Bosco.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
After the circus wild man. And, you know, so this circus wild man thing is really woven into the Bigfoot phenomena. I didn't realize how much until we started talking about it now. And yeah, the Zip thing is, I mean, that sagittal crest observation, Josh, that's dead on.
Coming.
He used to wear a hairy suit, too. Did you know that they made him a suit that was hairy that he used to wear?
Well, coming 2022, Where the Footprints End, High Strangers and the Bigfoot Phenomena, Volume 1, Folklore, Revised Second Edition.
Well, I mean, it couldn't, it's sort of like, it really is an intersectionality of everything that really is no longer culturally appropriate.
Well, and then here's sort of another little kind of mic drop. And I don't tend to dwell in these waters very often, but I will have to say, what is your stereotypical model of a Bigfoot hunter?
Yeah, I was thinking that as well.
White middle class dude, you know,
who loves to hunt.
Yep,
who loves to like hunt. Like the working class,
with modern variants of pith helmets.
Yeah,
or flannel.
The adventure hat, I would argue, is the modern variant of the pith helmet.
Well, and this sort of urge to capture and plant a flag, you know, in Bigfootery.
Oh yeah,
or in Bigfoot's forehead, I guess. Just plant a flag, bam.
Well, before we get to Bigfoot bingo, I'm trying to think of a way that we can neatly tie this up in a bow. Now, Volume 2 of Where the Footprints End is coming, with all hope and luck, before the end of 2020. So we have that to look forward to. Volume 1 we call Folklore, and Volume 2 we call it Evidence. Now, there's Evidence in Volume 1, and there's Folklore in Volume 2. We always like to mention that. These are just sort of general terms as to the general focus of each volume.
But you're not going to find a dedicated chapter on a folkloric archetype in Volume 2. Volume 2 is going to be much more about like tracks, lights, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think the closest that we get to that sort of folklore thing is my chapter on the trickster phenomena.
Yeah.
But
a little bit perhaps in the chapter on stick signs.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe a way to wrap it up or to talk a little bit more about the folklore aspect is it, and I know you talk about this, Tim, a lot, is that just because it's folklore doesn't mean it's not real.
Yeah. I love to point that out. Because there's, and I've heard these flesh and blood Bigfoot folks use folklore in a very derisive way. They will say, "Oh, that's just folklore," as if it's, you know, something dirty to talk about. And you know, as a folk singer, I would argue that there's so much value in folklore, and there's so much information there that is passed down through time. And I often mention that. There's a saying among ballad singers that, you know, a bad song doesn't get to become traditional. And I really feel there's some measure of truth to that. I'd argue there's a couple out there that for my personal taste, how did this one get to become traditional? But certainly in general terms, you know, very much seems to be the case. These things survive for a reason.
But and there's a universality to them.
Yeah, and they're passing down lessons often. I mean, there's... Mm-hmm. A lot of lessons in folklore, you know, this plant will heal you. This plant is going to kill you. Don't eat this plant, you know.
But do we know scientifically that the dapple gray is a faster horse than
that? No, the milkweight steed's always faster. Always faster, if you pay attention to folklore. No, but certainly there are lessons, and certainly they get exaggerated over time, and they get, maybe... You know, in one guy's group of horses, the milk whites were always faster than the dapple gray, and this becomes a trope. You know, and it's not universally true, but it was true for that guy. And I think these folklore stories that talk about these creatures and these entities and how to deal with them, I think, you know, there's grains of truth there that if you look at these modern reports and they're talking about the same things and they're, you know, these modern Bigfoot are acting the same way as these ancient wild men. They're doing the same things. They're banging on people's walls. They're climbing on people's roofs, which is just an odd detail that we find again and again with these wild men all over the world. For whatever reason, they climb on top of people's roofs. I don't even know. Yeah, I have a guess what that might mean symbolically, but you know, the purpose of that, I don't know. But you find that with these wild men stories everywhere.
I think your guess, if you want to sort of get into it briefly, I think it has some merit, because your idea is that maybe it's some sort of assertion of a spiritual hierarchy or something. The idea
it's kind of an otherness. It's in other words, you walk on the floors, we walk on the roofs. You know, we walk above you, kind of thing.
If you look at the work of former Sorbonne historian Claude Lecouteux, he that the reason that we have so much folklore surrounding, you know, the hearth and the fireplace is because the chimney itself sort of acts as an axis mundi between the mortal world and the other world as well. You know, that's why you would always dispose of changelings in the chimney, and spirits would fly in and out of chimneys, and why Santa Claus comes up and down out of the chimney. So I think there's
it's a time when something goes from being physical to being part of the ether.
Yeah.
Also true.
Absolutely. But I think that this folklore was our ancestors sort of telling us, like, this is the way we dealt with these weird things. And, you know, these stories get exaggerated and changed over time. That's the folk process. That happens. But I think there's some real merit to it. And especially, again, like I said, when you start overlaying these modern Bigfoot accounts and they just fit so well that it's you don't even have to change things. You don't even have to, like, say it sort of fits. These things fit perfectly over top of these ancient wild man accounts. It's not a stretch to me at all. So I think there's great value in folklore. Yes. All right, so Bigfoot bingo, Allison. Did you mark off your card?
Well, I think I didn't get as many written down as I had wanted to initially, but you definitely got relic hominid. We got your archetype. I think we did mention Percta, Aport. I don't know if we did the Giganticus thing. Did we say that?
Giganticus? No, we didn't. I thought. Before you give any more, let me guess what other ones might have been on there.
No, I didn't get to as many as I wanted to. Oh, okay. So
I was going to say, was Tapetum lucidum on there?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, I thought for sure it would have been.
It should have been. Gideon's like, what did Gideon say should be the center square? I think he might have said archetype should be the center square.
Great minds think alike.
Yep.
Well, Where the Footprints End, Volume 1 Folklore has been out since May. It's still out now. You can still get it. It's on Amazon. You can find links in the show notes under this and every episode. You can click on that. You can find it, I guess.
Paperback and Kindle.
And, you know, hopefully audiobook before too long. And we'll definitely be back to talk about Volume 2. And I'm sure Josh will be back for some reason before then.
Hopefully.
For our Bigfoot intersectionality episode, we will discuss feminism and racism within.
I do think you should write the feminist Bigfoot book, Allison.
Yeah, especially now that I've heard all this. Yeah, heck yeah.
Well, isn't it always the battle against the wild man that's trying to drag you off into the woods?
Well, I mean,
while you're trying to maintain your purity, and the only time that you really can get there is after you're no longer useful, when you're no longer bleeding and able to produce children, and when you start to get a hairy beard and you're a witch, that's when you're allowed to become a wise wild woman.
I mean, you know, at that point, she's leading the apes. So, yeah.
And there's plenty of iconography of, you know, apes abducting maidens in Africa. And that's something that you hear amongst indigenous tribes as well. And in North America is this idea that Bigfoot likes to take children and women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you get the occasional modern tale of you know, Bigfoot being interested. The Lover's Lane story, certainly. Bigfoot seems to be interested in people engaged romantically, presumably, you know, virgins or people of virgin age. I'm not speculating there. But there is generally, you know, I've heard people reference generally there's a kind of lack of sexuality to the Bigfoot mythos in general. You would expect more, I guess, stories of, you know, Bigfoot clubbing young maidens over the head and making off with them to the forest and so forth.
Well, you think you hear more of that than you did with the alien phenomenon, that they're just sort of like sexless, like the end times version of humans when we no longer need any kind of
it's also
gender or sexual identity at any level.
But I would push back. The sex thing is so baked into the UFO.
Yeah.
It's
at least reproduction.
Yeah, but even the pageantry of it all, like the anal probe and all that stuff is sort of.
But isn't Bigfoot sort of just sex in himself? Like, that's what you're trying to keep the maidens from doing. You know, like, go off with this more experienced, hairy, wild man. And you're trying to keep them away from sex generally.
You're not wrong.
You're trying to disempower their their burgeoning sexual power by telling them that everything that they can manifest with it is going to cause horror in their household, and that they better not go out in the woods and court that kind of behavior.
Yeah, again, I mean, there's so much there. Honestly, that book should be written.
Well, get on it, guys. I'm not that into feminism.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Allison, thank you for hosting our talk tonight.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thank you for indulging, what is a Bigfoot version.
Oh, and, no, this has been great, Allison. It's been awesome.
Yeah, wonderful. One of my favorite talks on the book so far. Thank you. And thank you, Josh.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Anytime either of you want to talk. Yeah, Allison, you want to call me up, we'll talk.
Cool, Josh.
Or Gideon or anybody, yeah. Or Ursula, yeah.
All sounds right. Good. And if Cooper or Ross want to call,
just babble into the phone.
Just babble into the phone. I would talk to him probably for a long time. Let's talk about mustard.
Yeah, right.
If you have a puppy and you're having problems with your puppy, say you're having problems connecting with your puppy, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you with a relationship-based approach. They can help you and your puppy become perfect for each other. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy has online sources, video lessons, a secret Facebook group, and one-on-one options are also available. You can find them at sithappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy will help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods. So whether you're having problems with potty training, fear and nervousness in your puppy, barking, if your puppy's chewing on furniture or shoes, if you're having trouble with crate training or hyperactivity issues, leash training, whatever you need help with, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you. They can teach you what to do, and perhaps more importantly, they can teach you what not to do. Again, you can find them at SitHappens, that's SitHappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. We want to thank Tina and 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy, who have been great supporters of Strange Familiars. Thank you very much. Well, speaking of supporters of Strange Familiars, I want to thank our patrons. Thank you so much, patrons. We have July's patron show coming to you very soon. We'll get it out before the end of the month here, and we should have the August patron show early in August. She should get some extra shows coming up here. I want to thank Steve for the fence. Your local listener who gave us a lot of fence.
Yeah.
It's sort of a wrought iron look fence. I don't think it's wrought iron, but it kind of has that wrought iron look to it. We will be replacing some rundown fence in our backyard with this. So thanks so much, Steve. Not only did he give it to us, but he
drove it to our house.
Yeah, drove half of it or more than half because we could only fit so much in the Jeep. So thank you once again, Steve. We're getting ready to buy a bunch of new hardware and software for the podcast. We've been limping along.
Oh, what? Macs aren't supposed to last 20 years?
We've been limping along a computer. You've heard us talk about it before. The software I use for editing, they don't even make anymore. I can't even get it an updated version. It won't run on new Macs. So when the old Mac goes, the editing software goes too. So I got to get new software. I got to get new hardware. So we have a lot of expenses coming up. I put a lot of new artwork up in our Etsy shop, all different price ranges, from $20 on up to hundreds of dollars there. I'm beginning to add all of the artwork from Don't Look Behind You, my fourth book. All of the art from Bigfoot in Pennsylvania and Beyond the Seventh Gate, my first two books, I believe has sold now. There's two pieces left from Bigfoot West Coast Wildman, my third book. So most of that's gone as well. And I've just begun to upload art from Don't Look Behind You. The good news is there's some small spot illustrations. So if you want a piece of original art and you don't want to drop a lot of money, that's a good way to get a piece. Pay attention to our Etsy shop. It's shop named Lost Grave. Links in the show notes. That artwork will be put up there in the next few days, probably over the next week, say. some of the pieces from Don't Look Behind You already spoken for. So if you have the book and you're looking through it and you want certain ones are gone. So you'll have to just keep an eye out on that Lost Grave Etsy shop. You know what I forgot? In our discussion of Circus Wildman, mm-hmm. you brought up Zip and you actually said they called him the What Is It?
Mm-hmm.
I actually have several Wildman articles, Victorian Bigfoot mm-hmm. articles in my books where they call them What Is It as well.
Yeah, I think it started with Zip, though.
Oh, I'm sure it did. It's just another connection that you even said it. They said, you said they called Zip a What Is It, and it didn't even occur to me at the time. As I was editing this episode, I went, oh, yeah, they called these, you know, Bigfoot wild men in Victorian times. Sometimes they called them What Is It as well. So just another connection. We really should write that into Volume 2. I'm not sure if Josh has the will to go back and add the circus stuff at this point to his chapter, because it would fit in best with his chapter. So we'll see. Speaking of circuses, photo of the week is a kind of a cool clown photo. It's not as creepy as some of our clowns.
Well, it is kind of creepy in that it's a really pretty young woman in like a French clown outfit, and she's holding a life-size clown up against a mirror, except for you can't see her in the reflection. You can only see the clown.
I didn't even notice that. Yeah, it's just him in the mirror. Now, is that just the angle of the mirror?
I think the whole thing's staged, maybe. I think okay. Maybe there's not really a mirror there because you'd get too many reflections anyway.
Gotcha. That's a really cool photo. It's a real photo postcard. And you have a guess on the year?
Yeah, it says 1913 at the top there. I'm going to say that's more than a guess. Yeah.
And it appears to have been sent to someone in Iceland.
Yeah.
As you pointed out.
For all the world, that looks like Reykjavik to me, so I'm going to go with
yeah.
that.
Really, really neat real photo postcard. Of some clowns.
He went to clown college.
So $30 for that. You can find that in our Etsy shop as well. We're trying to raise money for all the new equipment we need, so any little bit helps. But as we always say, it's a cool way to start a collection and help the podcast as well. Again, there'll be an image of that in the show notes. You can click on that, and it will take you right to our Etsy shop, where you can also find copies of my books, including Where the Footprints End, Volume 1. As mentioned previously, artwork, Strange Familiars t-shirts, all kinds of stuff in the Etsy Lost Grave Shop. If you're local to South Central Pennsylvania, you can find my books at American Daydream Antiques, which is on East Market Street in York.
Close to the shoe house. You don't get to say that too often.
It's not quite there, but yeah. Shoe house is technically Helm, right?
Yeah. It's close enough to the shoe house.
Close enough to the shoe house. In any case, you can find signed copies of my books there. That's the place to get them locally, American Daydream Antiques. We recorded an on-site show last week, which should be next week's show. I've listened to none of the audio we recorded, so hopefully it all turned out, but it should be a really neat show. I'm really excited for that one.
Yeah, it's a return to some weird history with a potential place where you can go and actually visit where
yes.
it took place.
Yes. So stay tuned for that. We'll be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more, darkhollerarts.com. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more. We're on Facebook. Facebook.com/StrangeFamiliars, where you can join the Strange Familiars gathering group, and we are on Instagram @StrangeFamiliars. Thank you.
kissing down to clay and bone. And may this song find you where you rest alone.
Flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.